Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 16. We're going to look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kings of Israel, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, and Ahab in this one chapter. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 15, we see Baasha wiping out the sons of Jeroboam the first. Nadab was ruling, and Nadab got killed, as well as all of Nadab's male relatives, and so the house of Jeroboam the first is wiped out in the last chapter. So we start now in 1 Kings 16, verses 1 through 7. Then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, son of Hanani, against Baasha. Now Baasha ruled from 909 to 886 B.C. to give us a little bit of orientation as to where we are. So here's the word of the Lord coming from Jehu, son of Hanani. Jehu says this, I lifted you up, talking to Baasha. I lifted you up from the dust and made you leader of my people Israel, but you walked in the ways of Jeroboam and caused my people Israel to sin and to provoke me to anger by their sins. So I am about to consume Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Of course, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, he is the first king of northern Israel who set up the golden calves, one in Dan and one in Bethel for idolatrous worship or worship of Yahweh under an idolatrous form. Jeroboam ruled 931 to 910. His son Nadab ruled from 910 to 909. And then Baasha killed Nadab, and Baasha ruled 909 to 886. So Jehu, who's a prophet, he goes to Baasha and says, look, I made you ruler of my people Israel, but you walked in the ways of Jeroboam. In other words, you continued the golden calf worship. So I'm about to consume Baasha, your house, Baasha, and his house, that means his relatives, his descendants, and I will make your house like that of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Now, how was Baasha's house like Jeroboam's house? Well, let's read what happened to Baasha's house in 1 Kings. Excuse me, let's see what happened to Jeroboam's house in 1 Kings 15:29. When Baasha became king, he struck down the entire house of Jeroboam. He did not leave Jeroboam any survivors, but destroyed his family according to the word of the Lord he had spoken through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So that's basically how Baasha's house is like Jeroboam's house. They both got wiped out. Verse 4, Jehu the prophet, Jehu the son of Hanani the prophet, continues with his prophecy to Baasha. Dogs will eat those belonging to Baasha who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. Well, that was also like the prophecy that was given by Ahijah the Shilonite against Jeroboam, against Jeroboam. It was given to Jeroboam's disguised wife. Let's read that in 1 Kings 14:10 through 11. This is what Ahijah the Shilonite says. Because of all this, I'm about to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will eliminate all of Jeroboam's males, both slave and free, in Israel. I will sweep away the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it is all gone. Anyone who belongs to Jeroboam and dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And anyone who dies in the field, the birds of the sky will eat. For the Lord has said it. So you notice the dogs eating the corpses in the city and the birds eating the corpses in the countryside is exactly what happened to the house of Jeroboam, and it's also prophesied is going to happen to the house of Baasha. Different prophets, but same results. Jeroboam's house was prophesied against by Ahijah the Shilonite, and Baasha's house was prophesied against by Jehu, the son of Hanani. We continue with verse 5. In 1 Kings 16, as for the other events of Baasha's reign, what he did and his achievements, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Baasha rested with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah. Tirzah, of course, is the capital, a little bit, maybe 10 miles or so north of Shechem. That was the first capital of the northern Israelites. Continuing with verse 6, Elah, his son, succeeded Baasha as king. Now, Baasha's son Elah ruled for 2 years, from 886 to 885. Verse 7, moreover, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Jehu, son of Hanani, to Baasha and his house, because of all the evil he had done in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger by the things he did in becoming like the house of Jeroboam, and also because he destroyed it. All right, so that's just a recap of the prophecy against Baasha by Jehu, the son of Hanani. Let's look at who this Hanani was, the father of Jehu. This Hanani is a prophet who reproved the southern king Asa and got put in jail for his trouble. This is in 2 Chronicles 16, verses 7 through 10. At that time, Hanani the seer came to King Asa of Judah and said to him, because you depended on the king of Aram, that's Syria, and have not depended on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hand. Were not the Cushites and Libyans a vast army with many chariots and horsemen? When you depended on Yahweh, he handed them over to you. For the eyes of Yahweh roam throughout the earth to show himself strong for those whose hearts are completely his. You have been foolish in this matter. Therefore, you will have wars from now on. Asa was angry with the seer and put him in prison because of his anger over this. And Asa mistreated some of the people at that time. So even though Asa is characterized as a good king, he had his bad moments, and Hanani reproved him for it. So Jehu comes from a good family. He has a good upbringing as a prophet because of his father, who spoke truth to power. Hanani was still living at this time. Probably Jehu was a young man. We hear of him several years after reproving Jehoshaphat. So let's see how Jehu continues. He's already reproved Baasha. Now he's going to go after Jehoshaphat, who's a southern king. He was considered a good king, too, but he still reproved him. 2 Chronicles 19:2. Then Jehu, son of Hanani the seer, went out to confront him and said to King Jehoshaphat, do you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Because of this, the Lord's wrath is on you. We'll talk about exactly what that was about when we get to King Jehoshaphat later on, but just notice, this Jehu is a fearless son of a gun. He's without fear at all. We later on hear that Jehu, the son of Hanani, actually wrote history in 2 Chronicles 20:34. The rest of the events of Jehoshaphat's reign from beginning to end are written in the events of Jehu, son of Hanani. Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible capitalizes the events of Jehu, son of Hanani, as if it's one book, which I'm sure it is. And that book is recorded in the book of Israel's kings, the annals of the kings of Israel that's mentioned all the time. Whoever recorded those annals just probably took Jehu's book and incorporated it. And by the way, that book of Israel's kings is not the canonical book of kings. That's confusing sometimes. It just means the annals, the chronicles of the kings. So Jehu rebukes Baasha, rebukes Jehoshaphat, writes some history of Jehoshaphat's reign. So he's a player. And his father Hanani had reproved Asa and got put in jail for it. So some interesting biographical facts here. Now in verse 7, Jehu, son of Hanani, prophesies against Baasha for a reason, prophesied judgment on him for a reason, because of all the evil that Baasha had done in the eyes of the Lord. That would be the golden calf worship. And there was another reason why Jehu, son of Hanani, prophesied judgment on Baasha. It's at the very last phrase of verse 7, also because he destroyed the house of Jeroboam. Well, you think, well, that was prophesied, that he was going to destroy the house of Jeroboam. What's he getting blamed for? He's carrying out God's will. It was prophesied by Ahijah the Shilonite, if you recall, to Jeroboam's disguised wife who had come inquiring about their son Abijah's health situation. So Baasha, it's been prophesied that Baasha's going to kill Nadab and wipe out Jeroboam's house. So why in verse 7 in 1 Kings 16, why is Baasha said to be judged because of it? Why is Jehu coming after Baasha saying, hey, you destroyed the house of Jeroboam? Well, Barnes answers that question. Albert Barnes, he says this, quote, though the destruction of Jeroboam had been foretold, and though Baasha might be rightly regarded as God's instrument to punish Jeroboam's sins, yet as he received no command to execute God's wrath on the offender and was instigated solely by ambition and self-interest, his guilt was just as great as if no prophecy had been uttered. And I think there's your answer right there. God uses evil people and their evil doings, like he used Babylon to chastise Israel by burning down Jerusalem, but that doesn't mean that Babylon was a wonderful empire that didn't need to be judged. The NIV translation here is a little bit unclear. That was the translation I'm using here to quote these verses. Let me read this verse again, verse 7. Moreover, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Jehu because of all the evil. Moreover, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Jehu, son of Hanani, to Baasha and his house because of all the evil he had done in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger by the things he did and becoming like the house of Jeroboam, and also because he destroyed it, because he destroyed the house of Jeroboam. The Holman Christian Study Bible makes it clearer and says, the word of the Lord came through Jehu because Baasha had struck down the house of Jeroboam. We go now to 1 Kings 16, verses 8 through 14. In the 26th year, that's 886 B.C., in the 26th year of Asa, who ruled from 911 to 870, in the 26th year, 886, king of Judah, Elah, that's E-L-A-H, Elah, who reigned from 886 to 885, Elah, son of Baasha, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah 2 years. Remember, Tirzah is the first capital of the northern tribes of Israel, just north of Shechem. Verse 9, 1 Kings 16, Zimri, one of his officials, one of Elah's officials, who had command of half his chariots, plotted against him. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the house of Arza, the man in charge of the palace at Tirzah. Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 27th year, that's 885 B.C., in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah. So Zimri kills Elah. So Elah is noted for getting drunk and getting himself assassinated while he was drunk. Then he, that's Zimri, succeeded Elah as king as soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne. As soon as Zimri began to reign and was seated on the throne, he killed off Baasha's whole family, thus fulfilling the prophecy of Jehu, son of Anani. Zimri did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. The reason they do that is so there won't be any claimants to the throne left. That typically happens when there's a revolution. So Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu. Because of all the sins Baasha and his son Elah had committed and caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols, namely the golden calves. Other idolatry had not been introduced yet. Ahab's going to get the honor for that. So this account of the book of Kings is basically a morality play. You sin against God, and the number one sin is idolatry. You do that, you die. Verse 14 is, for the other events of Elah's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Now we're going to see that Elah, while he's getting drunk in the house of Arza, his house steward, his palace steward, while he's getting drunk and getting assassinated, his army is off besieging a Philistine city called Gibbethon. Gibbethon is right north of the valley of Sorek, where Samson spent his days. And we'll note that Elah's downfall is remarkably similar to Nadab's downfall. So Jeroboam the first had a son Nadab. Nadab is wiped out, and Baasha has a son Elah, and Elah is wiped out, and Nadab and Elah are wiped out in very similar fashions. Both Nadab and Elah reigned for 2 years. They were both slain by their servants. Nadab of the house of Jeroboam was killed by Baasha, and Elah of the house of Baasha was killed by Zimri. Both Nadab and Elah were killed at a time when Gibbethon was being besieged. One difference is that Nadab was actually at Gibbethon and when he was killed by Baasha, whereas Elah was not at the siege of Gibbethon. He was getting drunk at his palace back in Tirzah. But other than that, the circumstances are remarkably similar. How do we know that Gibbethon was being besieged at the time that Elah was in the palace at Tirzah? Because we read in the very next verse, in the 27th year, that's 1 Kings 16:15, in the 27th year of Judah's king Asa, Zimri became king for 7 days in Tirzah. Now the troops were encamped against Gibbethon of the Philistines. Now we know that Zimri only lasted for 7 days after he kills Elah. And it says the troops were encamped against Gibbethon of the Philistines. That means that that was going on. That siege of Gibbethon was going on at the time that Zimri killed Elah. Now in verse 12, it says Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu. What was that word from Jehu? I've already read it, but I'll read it again. 1 Kings 16, 2 through 4. Because I raised you up from the dust and made you ruler over my people Israel, but you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have caused my people Israel to sin, provoking me with their sins. Take note, I will sweep away Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Anyone who belongs to Baasha and dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And anyone who is his and dies in the field, the birds of the sky will eat. So we move now to 1 Kings 16, verses 15 through 20. In the 27th year of Asa, that's 885 B.C., Asa, king of Judah, Zimri, reigned in Tirzah 7 days. The army was encamped near Gibbethon, a Philistine town. When the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, this King Elah, and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri the commander of the army, king over Israel that very day there in the camp. So Omri was besieging Gibbethon. Zimri is in the palace having murdered Elah. Zimri's not going to last very long. He's going to last 7 days. Omri, who ended up ruling from 885 to 874, is going to be a king for a long time after this. So the Israelites in the camp, that means the soldiers, proclaimed a new king, Omri. Zimri, of course, doesn't have any soldiers. He's all alone in the palace, and we're going to see that's probably why he killed himself. Verse 17, then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. So we're going to forget the Philistines now. We're going to have a civil war in Tirzah. Verse 18, when Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace and set the palace on fire around him. So he died because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord and walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in the sin he had committed and had caused Israel to commit. As for the other events of Zimri's reign and the rebellion he carried out, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Now, I had mentioned earlier that Nadab, son of Jeroboam, was besieging Gibbethon when he got killed by Baasha. It's unclear whether Nadab had failed in that earlier siege. It could be that Nadab had actually taken the city before he got killed by Baasha, and then the Philistines had retaken the city. I suspect he just had failed. Now let's look at this fire which consumed Zimri, the regicide Zimri. Why did he burn the city down? Well, several reasons. One is he knew he was doomed. Tirzah was not fortified, as John Gill says. Zimri had no army. Omri had the army at Gibbethon. So Zimri had no army to defend himself when Omri marched on Tirzah. It could be that Zimri burnt the palace and its royal treasure to keep Omri from enjoying it, just as a matter of spite. But I think the real reason is he knew he was doomed and that he would probably suffer gruesome torture and death under Omri, because that's what conquering kings did to their defeated victims. John Gill has an interesting comment. He says the text will also bear the sense that Omri burnt down the city, not Tirzah. Well, we're not going to go with that. All the translations say Zimri burnt it down. And so he died. Why? Again, because of his idolatry, walking in the ways of Jeroboam. Of course, that would be the golden calf worship. But a question might arise here. How could we say that Zimri is walking in the sins of Jeroboam, since Jeroboam only ruled for 7 days? Well, here's some suggestions to answer that. Zimri could have been worshiping the golden calves while he was captain of the chariots. In other words, before he became king for 7 days, he could have been worshiping the golden calves. During that 7-day period, he could have been sacrificing to golden calves as thanksgiving after usurping the crown. Thank you, golden calf. I just killed Elah. He could be even worse than that. Besides personally sacrificing to the golden calves, he could have issued decrees, legal decrees, at his ascension, commanding worship of the golden calves by the Israelites. That's all speculation, but we can be assured that things are getting worse and worse and worse. Actually, it doesn't say things are worse here. It just says he was doing evil. We're going to see later on that things are going to get worse as we progress through the kings of Israel. We go now to 1 Kings 16, verses 21 through 24. Then the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half supported Tibni, son of Ginniath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. But Omri's followers proved stronger than those of Tibni, the son of Ginniath. So Tibni died, and Omri became king. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel, and he reigned 12 years, 6 of them in Tirzah. He, that's Omri, bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. And, of course, he's going to move his capital to Samaria there. Now, this Tibni is otherwise unknown. He was probably allied with Zimri. And we can speculate that there was a civil war between Tibni and Omri. How do you figure that? Well, in 1 Kings 16, 10 and 15, we see that Omri became king in the 27th year of Asa. Here, after fighting Tibni, he became king in the 31st year. That's 4 years later. How do we explain that? Well, we explained that in this way. He probably had a co-regency with Tibni, my chart of all the kings of Israel and Judah, and their dates has a little asterisk there, and the asterisk stands for co-regency. So for the first 4 years of Omri's reign, he's sharing the reign with Tibni. So he took charge with Tibni in the 27th year of Asa of the south, and then in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah in the south, he became sole king of Israel. So Omri takes charge with Tibni between 885 roughly and 881, and then for the rest of the time between 881 BC and 874, he rules by himself after having beaten Tibni in a civil war. It says 22, but Omri's followers proved stronger. That's probably after a battle. Now, why did Omri move his capital from Tirzah to Samaria? Well, Tirzah had some problems. First of all, it had just been burnt by Zimri. It's not a nice place to have a burnt down city. And the city probably had suffered in the civil war between Tibni and Omri, that four-year war. So Omri moves the capital to Samaria. Now, if you look at the map, Shechem is in the bottom third of Ephraim. And then if you go about, 6, 7, 8 miles, 10 at the most to the northwest, you end up at Samaria. Now, at the time that Omri did this, Samaria is just a hill. It's not too much, but it became a famous city. Let me read you a little bit from the sources, the commentators, about Samaria. First from Adam Clark, quote, "The kings of Israel adorned and fortified Samaria. Ahab built a house of ivory in it. The kings of Syria had magazines or storehouses in it for the purposes of commerce. And it appears to have been a place of considerable importance and great strength. Samaria endured several sieges. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, besieged it twice. It cost Shalmaneser the fifth a siege of 3 years to reduce it." That was in finishing up in 722 BC. "It became the property of the kings of Egypt, but Antiochus the Great took it from the Egyptians." That's during the Seleucid period. "And it continued in the possession of the kings of Syria till the Asmoneans took it." That's in the first couple centuries BC, when the Maccabees set up the Hasmonean rule. The Hasmoneans, that Jewish kingdom, took Samaria and razed it to the ground. Gabinius, proconsul of Syria, partially rebuilt it. That's in the Roman Empire. Herod the Great restored it to its ancient splendor and placed in it a colony of 6,000 men and gave it the name of Sebaste in honor of Augustus. It is now a place of little consequence. This is in the 1800s, according to Clark. And a quick look at Wikipedia or other websites on the internet will tell you that Samaria still is quite an insignificant place. I'm looking at a picture now of Samaritan ruins in 1925. There's nothing there but an archaeological site. Jameson Fawcett Brown, quoting a gentleman named Stanley, says this about Samaria, quote, "Naturally influenced by considerations both of pleasure and advantage in the center of a wide amphitheater of mountains about 6 miles from Shechem, rises an oblong hill with steep yet accessible sides and a long flat top extending east and west and rising 500 or 600 feet above the valley. What Omri in all probability built as a mere palatial residence became the capital of the kingdom instead of Shechem. It was as though Versailles has taken the place of Paris or Windsor of London. The choice of Omri was admirable in selecting a position which combined in a union not elsewhere found in Palestine, strength, beauty, and fertility." We proceed now to 1 Kings 16, 25 through 28, and we will continue with the reign of Omri. But Omri, remember he ruled from 885 to 874, "But Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and sinned more than all those before him. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. As for the other events of Omri's reign, what he did and the things he achieved, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Israel? Omri rested with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab, his son, succeeded him as king." Now, Omri is said in verse 25 to do more than all the other golden calf worshippers who came before him. Well, how did he do more? John Gill states that this is how he did more sin. Quote, Not only did he worship the calves as the rest and drew Israel by his example into the same as they did, but he published edicts and decrees obliging them, to worship the golden calves, and forbidding them to go to Jerusalem. And these decrees were called the Statutes of Omri. Gill quotes Micah 6:16, which I'll read. The statutes of Omri and all the works, of the house of Ahab are observed, and in their devices you walk. Therefore, I will give you up for destruction and your inhabitants for derision, and you will bear the reproach, of my people. So here in Micah, we see that Micah actually codified, or Omri did, Omri codified the golden calf worship and put it in law, in legal decrees and statutes, and force the people to worship the golden calf. So that's why he sinned more than all those who came before him, as verse 25 says here in 1 Kings 16. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Of course, that's the golden calves, because that's what Jeroboam did. He set up the golden calf worship, one calf in Dan in the north and one calf in Bethel in the south. And verse 28, Omri rested with his fathers, was buried in Samaria, his new capital city, and Ahab succeeds his son. Now, Ahab, we're going to see in just a minute, was the worst king of the northern kingdom. At least some people say that. I think that's probably true. But before we get to evil Ahab, let's look at Omri and give a summary of events during his reign. First of all, he was the first king that had a co-regency, the co-regency with Tibni. He had a civil war with Tibni. He codified the golden calf worship, as we infer from Micah 6:16. He moved the capital of northern Israel from Tirzah to Samaria. And also, another interesting fact is the prophet Elijah started prophesying during his reign. Elijah lived from about 900 B.C. to 849 B.C. 900 to 849, and Omri's 885 to 874, so that's roughly the same period. And the prophet Micaiah also prophesied during Omri's reign. Micaiah is one of the four disciples of Elijah, not the prophet who wrote the book of Micah. It's a different prophet, one of Elijah's disciples. But they prophesied during the times of Omri. So that despite the relatively short description of what Omri did, that there were some somewhat momentous events that happened during the reign of Omri, at least interesting events. So now let's turn to bad King Ahab. 1 Kings 16, verses 29 through 33. In the 38th year, that's 874 B.C., of Asa. Asa ruled from 911 to 870 B.C. So in the 38th year of Asa, which was 874, king of Judah, Ahab, who ruled from 874 to 853, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, that's the golden calves, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Eshbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. Now, the famous Jezebel that Ahab married, Adam Clark's got six salient facts to remember about Jezebel. Number one, she was the idolatrous daughter of an idolatrous king. That would be Ethbaal of Sidon on the Mediterranean coast. Number two, she practiced her idolatry openly. Point number three, she not only countenanced idolatry in others, but she protected it and gave its partisans honors and rewards. Point number four, she used every means to persecute the true religion. Number five, she was hideously cruel and put to death the prophets and priests of God. Point number six about Jezebel, she did all this with the most zealous perseverance and relentless cruelty. That's why you don't find many parents naming their daughters Jezebel. There's a famous Hollywood movie, Betty Davis, I think she lost the role of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, so Gone with the Wind's competitors, the producers of Gone with the Wind had competitors, of course, and so they did a movie called Jezebel, and she was the evil Jezebel. Jezebel always stands for evil, for good reason. Now, Ahab set up an altar for Baal, and also a temple for that altar in Samaria. Now, this is a lot worse than golden calf worship, because golden calf worship was worship of Yahweh, the true God. Baal is the worship of a pagan god that is a no god that doesn't exist. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says of this Baal, quote, "That is the sun worshipped under various images. Baal's a sun god. Ahab set up one of these images." We just read that. "Probably as the Tyrian Hercules in the temple in Samaria. No human sacrifices were offered." Well, thank God for small favors. "The fire was kept constantly burning. The priest officiated barefoot. Dancing and kissing the image were among the principal rites." Well, this word "more" in verse 33 tells us that Ahab was worse than all of the bad kings who came before him in northern Israel. He made an Asherah pole. That was a pole to honor Baal's consort Astarte, the fertility goddess, the Easter egg goddess, the fertility goddess with many breasts and who had Easter eggs, Astarte eggs, to celebrate her fertility. These eggs were scattered all around her in many places, and that's why we have Easter eggs today on Resurrection Sunday. If you can think of the incongruence of that fact, it might make you rethink this nonsense of going around and chasing colored eggs on Resurrection Sunday. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord. That's the one word I was saying to focus on. How did he do more? Because Baal worship is worse than golden calf Yahweh worship. We go now to 1 Kings 16:34, and we'll finish this audio. In Ahab's time, and remember Ahab ruled from 874 to 853 B.C., in Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. Now, this incident of Hiel of Bethel rebuilding Jericho is not really connected with Ahab, but it's during his time, and so that's why the author here tells us about the story. And the reason why it's significant is because it completely fulfills a prophecy by Joshua. So let's read that prophecy, Joshua 6:26. "Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, 'Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gate.'" So you see there, those words are quoted from Joshua directly here in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 34. The difference being is that the actual names of the firstborn and secondborn, or youngest son, not secondborn, but youngest son, those two names are given. The first son was Abiram, and the youngest son was Segub. Now, there have been three opinions on exactly what did Joshua mean here and what happened. We know that Joshua eventually put a curse on Jericho because Jericho was so opposed to God. And you recall the story of Jericho, of Joshua walking around the walls of Jericho seven times in order to destroy it. And it's mentioned here in 1 Kings 16 to show the fulfillment of that prophecy. But the question is what did Joshua mean and how was it fulfilled? Well, there are three opinions on that. But before I get to those three opinions, let me point out that there's some speculation as to why Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho when Joshua put that awful curse on the city. It could be that Hiel was ignorant of Joshua's curse, or it could be that Hiel built the city of Jericho in complete contempt and defiance of Joshua's adjuration on Jericho. In other words, he might have done it ignorantly. He might have done it on purpose. Nobody really knows. It could be that he did it because he knew it would please the king and queen, Ahab and Jezebel, who, of course, were rebellious against Yahweh. But whatever he did, we're not exactly sure of his motives, but he shouldn't have done it. Now, one more issue before I get to the three options as to what was meant by this curse. Let's read what John Gill says about Segub, the last of the youngest child. Let me read this again in 1 Kings 16:34. "He set up its gates, Hiel set up its gates, Jericho's gates, at the cost of his youngest son, Segub." Now, John Gill says this, quote, "All the rest of his children died as he was rebuilding the city," as Hiel was rebuilding the city, "until only his youngest son was left, and he was taken off by death just as he had finished it, signified by setting up the gates of it." Well, Gill says that what happens was that the oldest son died when Hiel started building the city, laying the foundations, and then son number two, son number three, till youngest son was all that's left, and he died when the gates were set up. But I point out to you, that's not what the text says. It could be that what Gill says is true, but the text does not say that there were intermediate children who died. It just mentions the firstborn and the youngest. If they were intermediate children, we don't know. Gill speculates that they were dying also. So now let's get to the three options, the three opinions of what this curse of Joshua meant. Now, Adam Clark gives you the three opinions, but he says that he cannot pretend to state, which is correct. In other words, he's just reporting and letting us decide. So I'll do the same thing. Here's the first option. Hiel starts rebuilding the city, and then God strikes down the oldest son when the foundation was laid, and then when we get to the gates to be put up by Hiel, God struck down the youngest son. Adam Clark says this, quote, "When he laid the foundation of the city, his eldest son, the hope of his family, died by the hand and judgment of God." So we see it's God doing it, according to option one. "And that all his children died in succession, so that when the doors were ready to be hung, his youngest and last child died." Clark agrees with Gills that there were intermediate kids in between. "And thus, instead of securing himself a name, his whole family became extinct." Okay, the problem with that option is, why would Hiel keep building, seeing that his first son was killed? He said, "Oh my gosh, my son was killed." Let's see now. Back in my memory, I heard something about a curse that Joshua put on this place. And you would think that would stop him, especially if their intermediate son's dying, which is a speculation. But if they were, that would make the argument even stronger as to why this option can't be right, because why would Hiel keep going in the face of his son's getting killed? Here's option number two. The expression that Joshua used merely means that it was going to take a long time to rebuild Jericho. In other words, we go back to Joshua's words. Hiel laid Jericho's foundation at the cost of his firstborn son. In other words, with the labor of his firstborn son. And then he set up at the gates at the cost of his youngest son. In other words, by the time the youngest son came around, working. Then Jericho was built. So there, in that interpretation, none of the sons die. It just means a long time between the oldest son and the youngest son. It took a long time to rebuild Jericho. Here's what Adam Clark says to state that option. Quote, "These expressions signify only great delay in the building, that he who should undertake it should spend nearly his whole life in it, all the time in which he was capable of procreating children. In a word, that if a man laid the foundation when his firstborn came into the world, his youngest and last son should be born before the walls should be in readiness to admit the gates to be set up in them. And that the expression is of the proverbial kind, intimating greatly protracted labor occasioned by multitudinous hindrances and delays." Now, that opinion attracts those who think that God wouldn't kill innocent children working on Jericho, but as we've seen in many other cases, innocent children do die because of the sins of their fathers. Hiel really shouldn't have been trying to build Jericho and was under a curse. Now, whether that's a proverb or not, I don't know, but it seems reasonable to me that that could be a proverb, and so that nobody died in rebuilding Jericho. Here's option number three. The rebuilder of Jericho would actually slay his children to consecrate the rebuilt city of Jericho. So option number one is God killed the oldest and the youngest child. Option number three is Hiel killed the oldest and youngest child. The oldest child at the laying of the foundations. The youngest child at the laying of the foundation. Excuse me, the oldest child at the laying of the foundation and the youngest child when the gates were put up. Here's what Clark says of option number three. "That he who rebuilt this city should, in laying the foundation, slay or sacrifice his firstborn in order to consecrate it and secure the assistance of the objects of his idolatrous worship, and should slay his youngest at the completion of the work as a gratitude offering for the assistance received." This latter opinion seems to be countenanced by the Chaldee, in the translation, which represents Hiel as slaying his firstborn Abiram and his youngest son Segub. Well, I have trouble with that, too. Why would you kill your own kids just to rebuild a city? I don't understand ancient culture, but it seems to me that's a little far-fetched. So I think it's either option number one or option number two. The children died by the hand of God, but then why would Hiel keep working? So if it's a proverb, this means a long time. That'll work, too. But I'm like Adam Clark. I do not pretend to state which is correct. Adam Clark says of Jericho, "A curse seems to rest still upon Jericho. It is not yet blotted out of the map of Palestine, but it is reduced to a miserable village consisting of about 30 wretched cottages and the governor's dilapidated castle, nor is there any ruin there to indicate its former splendor." Well, that was written in the 1800s. I looked on Wikipedia. I think it's about 18,000 people there now. A couple of buildings. I mean, it's not totally dilapidated as Clark describes it, but it's still not much. At any rate, all this is a lot of discussion about the rebuilding of Jericho, and the main point we need to remember here is that Hiel is rebuilding the very walls that God had torn down, and this is painful evidence how far the people of Israel had lost all knowledge of or respect for the Word of God, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown so correctly say. So we are now prepared to go to our next audio in 1 Kings 17, 1 through 24, the entire chapter, and we will turn from the depressing history of apostate kings, and we will go into Bible story territory. We will look at Elijah and the widow of Zarephath. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.